Joe, how you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. So this week we wanted to talk about who is they, that question we always get. Whenever we're discussing what conspiracies or controversial events like 9/11 or JFK or even things like education and the medical industrial complex, we'll say they're doing this, they've done this, they decided to do this. And sometimes we get into the stuff, you'll see the person's eyes start to glaze over, or maybe he's just not aware of these things. And he says, yeah, who is they? You're always saying they. Well, who is they? Well, that's a question we're always confronted with. But actually, there are some individuals and groups we can identify throughout history, they, if you will, who have conspired and done some pretty criminal, dastardly things. Obviously, a lot of what we see going on around the world requires agency, planning, coordination, organization. So so these institutions or organizations have to exist at some level. They have to operate. They have to spend money, utilize resources, coordinate, communicate, even have a paper trail. So, Joe, who is they? Who would they be?
Gee, what a good question. Well, first of all, it is the most fundamental question of our age, in my opinion. There is sort of this capacity to stop conversation in its tracks with this question, which is, of course, rhetorical. I mean, in other words, a person who brings it up typically would have the position that there is no they, that there couldn't be a kind of organizational aspect to a conspiracy, because you have the media, you have all these people who would have to be involved. And as reality is presented to us, as we see the political leaders and our media leaders, they're not in any organizational structure, right? So it is a question that is rhetorical and is designed to just show the folly of believing in an organization. And I think that position made some sense before 9/11, but after the events of that day, it doesn't any longer, because, as we've discussed on the show, there was clearly an inside aspect to that attack, that you had a building that fell symmetrically, free fall speed, had a gigantic pyroplastic dust cloud, and there was foreknowledge. Obviously, the BBC announcer talked about the building having collapsed before it did. We've gone through all these things. So there had to have been a they to have created that. There had to have been an organizational structure to the media and governmental leadership, certainly, that we don't understand or know about. So since 9/11, I think it is, it's no longer a question of theory, it's a question of, well, who are they? There is a whole series of secret societies that are linked into the organization, and these are, we'll go over quite a few of them today. But at some point, after we've laid some groundwork, I want to actually talk about the history of the organization and how it keeps itself secret, and give suggestions as to who, you know, it might be and how it maintains its secrecy. But for right now, I just want to say that there is a they. Since 911, it's not any longer something that, in my opinion, can be really contested. So the ruling class, you can call it, and that includes the media, the military, the government, elements of it, have some kind of way of organizing themselves that we just don't know about. So, Tim, I'm going to just throw it back to you for a second. Now, first of all, like when you think of they, of the organization, what comes to your mind first, and what do you think people should know about the things that you're aware of concerning the organization?
I would immediately go to existing agencies like the Central Intelligence Agency or the Mossad or MI6, SIS, you know, Secret Intelligence Services, British Service. These intelligence agencies that do indeed exist, and they were created for a specific purpose to pursue the interest of a specific group, a small group of elitist. And if you just go through, study a cursory history of these organizations, you can find the names, the places, the dates, and the events surrounding their creation. The CIA is a great example of that, 1947-1948, when this was sort of a consummation of an untoward affair between big business and government that had been going on for the better part of a century, at least in the United States. It really goes back further in the British Empire. You know, you can get the names of Robert Lovett, Alan Dulles, his brother John Foster Dulles, the people that wrote the report to create the CIA. They're all on Wall Street. They're all represented corporations. You know, they all worked at, you know, it's Sullivan and Cromwell, the law firm, which represented, you know, Standard Oil and its constituent parts after it's broken up, whether it's Exxon Mobil and these things, or, you know, United Fruit Company. And they all, if you look at it, it's funny how the directors of Central Intelligence always happen to be a stockholder or a member of the board of ITT or United Fruit whenever there was an operation occurring that was benefiting that corporation at the expense of some, you know, benighted third world country, you know, like Guatemala or Chile or Iran or something, you know. And if you go to, you know, events like in Iran in 1953, that was, you know, it was the British intelligence working with the CIA to dethrone Mossadegh, to reinstall the Shah for the benefit of Anglo-American oil interests. And you can actually, you know, see immediate beneficiaries like Kermit Roosevelt, who was given a vice president's position, sort of a well-paid sinecure at Gulf Oil after he led that operation. That operation was also spearheaded by, I think, Schwarzkopf, the father of the general who would later, you know, lead our victorious forces against the evil Saddam Hussein in the first Gulf War in 1991. So the names are there, the connections are there. Names like Roosevelt and Rockefeller pop up everywhere, you know. So, you know, you can make those connections. Go to the agencies and these things. That's where I go. Of course, that's not the tip of the pyramid, but that's definitely something you can look at and you can say, oh, yeah, yeah. It's a question of who owns these companies, these corporations, which always goes back to high finance. Rockefellers, Rothschilds, and you know, those are the ruling elite, you know, maybe banking families and things like that. So that's what I think of as they.
Right. The problem that most critics would present to you, the ones who bring up the question as a rhetorical device, you know, to show the folly of conspiracy theory, is that that there would be different perspectives represented, and so the relationship would come to the public's attention, and they couldn't really be a real they. They couldn't be a an overall organization, because either someone inside the leadership cohort or one of the media who was analyzing, you know, the group would bring that information out, and then the public would know that they were in existence. I think that the most common sort of centrifugal energy that's given to the group is finance. In other words, they all have a financial interest in the success of this kind of secret government. they all benefit from it.
So sort of a follow the money is a good analytical or forensic technique to identify the conspirators.
Right, exactly. And so that's the most common path, and I think it's a really good one, and I think it leads oftentimes, you know, to the truth, and you get to see that the organization has been really focused on basically acquiring the wealth of the world.
Yeah, and what's interesting is when the established news organizations, media, government, refuse to follow the money, like in 9/11, is evidence of a cover-up.
Right.
Yeah.
And so with 9/11, you have thousands of American civilians killed. And so the idea that the organization that brought that about, because I think that 9/11 was, you know, is that, to me, that's kind of the red line. That's what, you know, gives us now the clarity that they exist. It doesn't make any sense from a purely financial, perspective. 9/11 on one level is the political cover for the Middle East wars. And so maybe you can argue that, well, the Middle East wars are being, you know, conducted because they're making a lot of people rich. But I think that's not a completely satisfactory answer. I think that there's a lot, more to the wars than just that. And I think that a really good place to look at who they are is the Project for the New American Century, the group that produced the position paper, which predicted 9/11 and then the subsequent Middle East wars, and basically had the order reversed. In other words, the position paper said we have to take out all of these Muslim countries, and it called for full spectrum dominance, which basically is reducing them to extinction or a very feeble slave state condition.
This is the rebuilding American defenses?
Yeah, I love the title.
Well, you know, because the Pentagon is only getting $300 billion a year.
Yeah, it's not enough to really carry on a good war. But anyway, so that paper, called for what became our future, and it also envisioned 9/11. In my mind, it's the same foreknowledge that the BBC announcer who saw the Solomon Building collapse before it happened had. Because, it said, well, we need a new American Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
And then, by God, we had one.
And given the true nature of that, of the Pearl Harbor event, it's really telling.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, it just couldn't be clearer that you got a false flag here. And then you also have a moral perspective that, again, people, when they talk about who is they, one of the things that they're kind of inferring is that evil of this nature would be exposed. They can't imagine so much evil. But in the Project for the New American Century position paper, Rebuilding Americans Defensive, you have the goal stated of developing an ethnic specific bioweapon. So when you talk about they and who they are, what is their moral perspective? Here it is. Right. The people who would create an ethnic specific bioweapon that would just kill an ethnicity. Right. We're not talking about those who are evil inside a group, but rather destroy an ethnicity. I mean, this is the moral perspective of people who would create a false flag and then, a series of very weak excuses for nation destruction in the Middle East, right? It's just clear as a bell. Here is the evil proudly manifesting itself that then could go forward with such a plan, we're going to just take out country after country. Now, this isn't, in my opinion, being done primarily for an economic advantage. I mean, what's happening here is the defense of Israel. So Israel is a focus of the Project for the New American Century. In fact, of the people who sign on to it, you have just an amazing collection of dual citizens, people who are both Israeli citizens and American citizens.
Joe, there are no such thing as Jewish conspiracies. You're obviously paranoid. There are only a few Jews who happen to be conspiring.
I know the world is so bewildering to me, Jim. It doesn't really make any sense. But anyway, so this is, you know, these are the facts. But the question is, when you get to the question of who they is, well, what would then be the relationship between the Israelis and Jewish individuals in the Project for the New American Century? And it was started actually by the a group that was Jewish, right? They were the neocons, and they had basically created this think tank, and then people like, the Bush administration basically signed on to the Project for the New American Century 100%. But you also had Democrats. Joe Biden signed it. Okay, so but the Democrat-Republican merger isn't as confusing as is the Gentile-Jewish merger, because this creates the impression like, well, this isn't a Jewish conspiracy, or this isn't a conspiracy of, zealot fundamental Christians trying to bring back Jesus by basically acting out the book of Revelation in the Middle East. This is a combination of people. So you can't really come up with a they. You see my point? Mm-hmm. It's that combination that is so bewildering, because you go, well, I guess there isn't a they. I guess you just have a bunch of crazy people, or however you want to characterize them, but they've come together around this principle of the defense of Israel, the destruction of the Muslim nations, and it's just a group of people, and there's not any one them to it. Now, I think that this combination begs a question of, well, how actually do they get along? And I want to give another example of them, because the reason why is because it's a video representation, and it would be fun, I think, for people who are listening to our talk to go and actually look at this. You can go and see, it's called A Conversation on LSD. And there you have a whole bunch of people, all of them engaging in a bizarre conversation about LSD and how it became a cultural phenomena. And these are all the people who created it. You know, you have a whole bunch of basically Jewish psychiatrists and psychologists. You have, Nicholas Burkell, Sidney Cohen. There's just maybe five or six of these guys. They're all sitting in a room, and who are they with? Well, they're with like Tim Leary, Hubbard, Huxley's wife, and then Huxley's partner, Humphrey Osman, right? So you have these Gentiles and Jews, and they're all talking about, how did it come about? You know, how did the LSD and the whole counterculture come about? And Sidney Cohen is talking about, well, some people say that we have like influence from the CIA. Is that possible? And of course, they're talking without knowing that the MKUltra pay requisitions eventually will get out. You see, this is the point, because you can see that all of these guys, or many of them, are actually MKUltra doctors. And you can also see the relationship between the strand that is related to Huxley and MKUltra. So you can see that all these people are lying. They all know the truth. They all know that the counterculture was a deliberate creation, and they were all getting money through the CIA. At one point, they start talking about a secret check that Hubbard had for $1 million. And they say, well, we can't talk about that. We can't talk about who gave us the money. You know, so they have this secrecy. But the point is, if you understand that the counterculture was created, with this malevolent purpose, then you can see that this is them again. This is the same thing as the Project for the New American Century. And here again, you have this collection of Jewish guys in this case, not dual citizens. These are all Jewish psychiatrists that work for the CIA. And then a whole bunch of purportedly Gentile counterculture guys like Huxley's wife, Tim Leary, Humphrey Osmond, Hubbard. And you see, what I would say is that when you look a little bit deeper, you can see that the Gentiles have connections into secret societies, right? Secret societies. Leary, of course, actually talked about the fact that he was basically, and you know, he was mainly put into motion through Aleister Crowley, right? You know, this kind of bizarre form of Freemasonry. Aldous Huxley, you know, very much an adherent to Freemasonry, and Hubbard and Humphrey Osmond are working through him. And so you've got the stench of a secret society over the Gentiles. Now, if you go back and look at the Project for the New American Century, you can see that, again, you have secret societies. You have some military intelligence, people you don't really, who are these guys? But you certainly have, you know, Bush's connection into Skull and Bones and the Cheney family's connection into Skull and Bones. And you've got, you know, this secrecy on that is involved in some of the Gentiles, and then you have all of these Jewish guys. So my question is when we look at reality, you can see, you know, tremendous Jewish political power, Jewish financial power, but then you have all of these strange actors that are Gentiles, like the Bush family, the Roosevelts, the Churchills, right? So often, I mean, in the three I just listed off the top of my head, you have connections back to secret societies. Okay. So the question is what is the relationship, Tim, between the secret societies, between Skull and Bones, the Freemasonries, and even, you know, in my opinion, the CIA, and Jews, because they have some kind of relationship like the centrifugal energy that creates they have some kind of connection that the public doesn't understand. How can these guys do something like 9-1-1? What would be the position, the kind of centrifugal glue, you know, that holds them together, that would enable group that you would think would have a lot of differences that couldn't be held together, that would have antagonism and would have, you know, fissures that would then, you know, reveal the conspiracy would fall apart. So that's the question I have, is what do you think holds these two groups together, the secret societies that the Gentiles belong to and the Jews who are often on the other side of the, you know, of the group collection?
Well, I think the obvious suspect, or where you look for maybe some sort of bloodline connection, meaning that there's obviously with a bloodline, you can maintain a certain degree of loyalty and coordination, even in a realm of, say, different interests. Same way a crime family may operate, or a series of crime families may intermarry. And this is why intermarriage is such an important part of the elite, cousin, someone's third, fourth cousin, these things. So perhaps further, somewhere along the line, they're actually really tied into by blood, which goes into this whole question of, crypto Jew and overt Jew, right?
Right, and it's a really good question, because if you look at the kind of the fundamental secret society, I would say it's the Freemasons. Mm-hmm. Look at the United States. I mean, Washington is a Mason. All of his generals are Masons. Over half of the people who are creating the Constitution are Masons. And so you have like
the King of England's a Mason.
The King of England is a Mason. His general is a Mason. I mean, it's sort of like World War I, where you just have Masons everywhere on both sides of the aisle, and everyone is dying. And so my point is that the Freemasons, right, have this oddball connection to Judaism vis-a-vis that critical character, you know, in their theology or ideology, Hiram Abiff, who is the builder of the temple. And so the building of the temple of Jerusalem is the fundamental symbolic structure of Freemasonry, far as I can tell. Now, it's a secret society. I do study it, but that's the best I can come up with, is that Hiram Abiff and the building of the Temple of Jerusalem are the fundamental structure, right? That's their basic symbolic way of looking at the world. Now, what's interesting is that Freemasonry actually can go back at least one iteration to the Knights Templar.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now the Knights Templar, who are they? Well, nothing is known about them except for the fact that they took the Temple of Jerusalem as their primary symbol, the Templar, the temple they're referring to as the Temple of Jerusalem, and they are known by a couple different historical strands of documentation to have gone to the Temple of Jerusalem and attempted to dig underneath it, trying to find something. Okay, that's the, you know, nothing is known about the group. It went out of existence. But it is known that it's the leader, De Molay, was captured by the Vatican and executed on Friday the 13th, which is the basis of the day being unlucky, supposedly. And that De Molay is basically a kind of a sainted individual in Freemasonry. I mean, they call their youth camps De Molay camps. That would be where Walt Disney or Bill Clinton went as young people, you know, to study whatever they study inside these things. So you have this connection into the Temple of Jerusalem. Now, I would point out that there's a linguistic trajectory that may have some, you know, kind of ability to shed light on all this. In modern Greece, the language, modern Greek, excuse me, the word for Freemason is tekton, and it's an ancient word that is also found in the New Testament. Jesus is referred to as a tekton, or actually they ask the question, is he a tekton? His father is said to be one. Joseph is a tekton. Now, they translate the word as carpenter, but this is clearly incorrect for two reasons. One, you can see by the modern Greek usage, it means mason, because tekton is the word for Freemason in Greece today. That's how you would refer to the Freemasons, as the tektons. But beyond this, if you look at the Gospels, you've got just tons of Masonic symbolism. They translate the word as carpenter, but in fact, it's logically translated as Mason because, you know, they have all of the Masonic symbolism from the Old Testament that is used in the New Testament, you know, make straight a path for the Lord, the plumb line, the cornerstone. If you look at the nickname for the lead apostle, it's stone or rock, right? It's a Masonic framework that you're dealing with in the Gospels, not one about wood or carpentry. So it's translated as Jesus is the son of a carpenter, but actually it should be Jesus is the son of a mason, and that would actually then make his birth date have some significance because he would have been crucified in his 33rd year. You see,
yeah,
that being a critical number for Freemasons. So now, if this is the case, right, the strand of analysis would then go into the histories of Josephus, because Josephus also uses the word tekton in a very, very peculiar way. He talks about at the conclusion of the Roman siege of Jerusalem, that the leaders, who are Simon and John, which in my opinion are lampoons of the characters in the Gospels, or the characters in the Gospels are lampoons of them, that these individuals are underneath Jerusalem, and they are with a group that Josephus calls the tektons. So this group is a group that Josephus is setting aside from ordinary Jews. right? The Tectons are the last ones left. They are they're trying to use their skills at engineering to dig out. And then they can't do it. And Simon then pops up at the corner of where the temple used to be, and claims to be a king. He's dressed in purple. But you see, this is sort of like the fulfillment of the of Jesus making, you know, Peter the cornerstone or Simon the cornerstone of the new religion. And suddenly, you know, you have this event in the Roman Jewish War. So anyway, sorry to ramble, but it's just my thought here is that there might be an actual linkage in fact, not just a linguistic language, but that you might have had in the first century a kind of special architecturally minded group that was involved with the Jewish rebellion called the Tectons, and that Josephus was actually referring to this group, and that this would then explain like why Jesus was called the son of a Tecton and why he was killed in his 33rd year, that these are kind of, you know, symbolic ways to basically talk about Roman understanding the secrets of the Masons and taking control over them. I don't know, but I just know that, you know, these strands kind of exist and they do produce a kind of coherent way of understanding history. In other words, if you think of the Freemasons as group of crypto Jews, right, who then take over political control of Europe and have the perspective of the war in the first century, right? Mm-hmm. Now then, like the, World War I makes perfect sense because now you have, well, wait a second, this was basically a way to bring victory to this group. The group had spent a long time getting, you know, political and financial control over Europeans. They then could maneuver, the groups into, positions where they would basically destroy each other. And now suddenly World War I is very coherent, and as is the, Masonic control over both sides of the mm-hmm. of the trenches, you know.
Yeah.
Now the question is, well, how could you prove this? You know, I would go back to your suggestion earlier that you'd want to try to do it with bloodlines.
Yeah. That's because that way, yeah, again, like, yeah, that's how you, that's how a group like this would organize and maintain some degree of loyalty or coherence. And that's historically always been the most reliable way to organize a criminal organization.
Yeah, well, like the mafia.
Yeah.
I mean, think about the mafia. I used to have arguments about this very thing with this friend of mine named Jerry Russell, and he would say, nah, there's just the, you know, he says, look, there's just no way a group could keep itself coherent, you know, through time. And I always say, well, you know, Jerry, what about the mafia? The mafia is a group that has family relations, you know, as a very important part of its ability to keep secrecy, mm-hmm. right? They're just a perfect parallel to what the suggestion is in terms of the Masons.
And they infuse it all with sort of Freemasonic rituals.
Right? Yeah, exactly. But I mean, the mafia then links into Freemasonry in so many ways, like P2, the whole P2 scandal, mm-hmm. where you get the mafia and Italian Freemasonry basically is, you know, working together. So that's, it's a grim thought. But it's something that, but on the other hand, it's one that I think you could actually, with a little bit of DNA testing, you know, get a, you know, to the bottom of, you know, is that really what we're facing here? Because, you know, when you look at 911, I mean, Tim, there definitely is a them there. It exists. Mm-hmm. And it's weird. It's not just finance or political power. There's something, you know, it has some kind of symbolic framework, a religious, quasi-religious framework, and it certainly is not worried about Gentile casualties.
No.
That doesn't seem to ever slow it down. And so, you know, I just, I mean, I just feel that Gentiles are entitled to a little bit of speculation and some, energetic investigation, because we're getting wiped out. And so, I would note, and I wanted to, just for make sure that people are aware of this, that, look, this isn't some kind of anti-Semitic slur. This isn't like, the Jews are engaged in an overall conspiracy against Gentiles. I'm talking about, this would be, the exact analogy would be the mafia relating to Italian people.
Yeah.
You know, it's 1% of the population. The problem is it's 98% of the criminal power.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the thing, is that I would be... I would expect that the vast majority of Jews would reject this out of hand, but they would do so because they would know the Jews that they associate with, and they would know there's no way they would participate in something like this.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because Carol Quigley in Tragedy and Hope, and that book itself was supposed to be written sort of as a guidebook or manual for upper middle level managers of the New World Order, for lack of a better term, CFR yeah. types and these guys. And it kind of got into the general population to the extent that any, 1200 page book can get into the general population. Very, very few people have actually read it. But he talks about during the French Revolution, the French Revolution itself was a Freemasonic project. Jacobins, Girondins, they were all Freemasons, and this was sort of an extension of the lodge in Great Britain, which was taken over by Freemasonry in 1717, and it sort of became an instrument for subversion and guile for the British Empire, for particularly the Whigs in the 18th century. And that's when it targeted France, because France was a Catholic throne. And this gets back to the Illuminist project, to destroy throne and altar, and to bring in this new world order. He says what happened in France was there was a battle going on more or less between Protestant and Jewish bankers. And the Jewish bankers went out, and this would be the Rothschilds. The Rothschilds gained ascendancy during the Napoleonic Wars. At the same time, they had become the bankers to the Vatican. So they were more or less covering all their bases here. And this is when it goes back to what you're saying about the bankers setting up Europe, for these wars. And it was at this point that perhaps they had gotten enough power through the banking system, through the weaponization of finance debt, that they could get these governments to do their bidding for them. And I think a good illustration of this is I was watching a documentary on Queen Victoria on PBS, and this involves the Suez Canal in 1870s. And it was at the time the British were looking to acquire it from the French, and the British government stepped in, I guess, for the benefit of some British investors, that they were going to acquire the canal from the French. I think originally it was a French project. And Disraeli, who was the prime minister at the time, a Jewish prime minister of Great Britain, couldn't raise the funds because Parliament wasn't in session. So he meets with Rothschild, who was a friend of his. And this is what standard history records. It goes, Rothschild was willing to loan the money to Disraeli to make the acquisition, because this would also be the furtherance of British imperial policy in the latter half of the 19th century, which also coincided with Zionism, as we know, with Palmerston. So we have that weird connection we're talking about. But then Rothschild says to Disraeli, what do you have as collateral, being the banker that he is? And Disraeli says, I offer you the British state. So, what inference do you draw from that, right? And so this is what happened with – this is the primacy of finance. And this is what Carol Quigley talks about in Tragedy and Hope, is that the ruling elite, this elite had, through finance, had more or less taken over the world, and this is where they set up these dialectics, and gets into the false dialectics of left versus right, elections and these things. And even Disraeli himself, I think, has a quote that said that we are ruled by personages we never see. They, more or less.
When it's very, very telling because it basically says that there is a they. That's what Disraeli is maintaining. Mm-hmm. But I would also point out that Queen Victoria is another just critical person to understand because she populated the thrones of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I forget how many children she had, but it was just she was a broodmare and had a dozen of them, and they all ended up, you know, in one form or another throughout the thrones of Europe at a point where there still is some political control vis-a-vis the monarchy. And so this is why, you know, when you have, you know, like World War One, it's been talked of as an internecine war because you have these cousins battling each other.
Yeah, George V, Wilhelm II, and Nicholas II.
God, Tim, you are a virtual encyclopedia to know that. That's awesome. But because I couldn't pull it up through my mind, but you're right. Now you're absolutely right. So my point here is that, okay, well, what if this is a Masonic family? And incidentally, it is. I mean, Victoria can be shown in her husband, you know, the German guy, you know, who is a Knight of the Garter, you know, kind of Mason.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very obvious Masonic family. And so what you're seeing is interesting, but it's in a really weird way because they're not only related, but they're all Masons.
Mm-hmm.
And so one, people say, well, you know, World War One was just this history unfolded and you know, these crazy things happened, no explanation. Well, how about the idea that this was the plan of the political class, right? And now this makes the genetic background of Victoria absolutely critical for people to understand.
Mm-hmm.
We just have to get to the bottom of it because, you know, you have the visible financial power and manipulation, but the political basis is something that the public doesn't, we don't understand what's in back of it. But if it was the case that Victoria was a crypto Jew and was part of a lineage from that perspective that was using Freemasonry as the shield, you know, to camouflage itself, now World War One, you know, and Victoria's relationship to it through her children, well, now suddenly it takes on a whole different reality.
Mm-hmm.
You see, and you see, oddly enough, this is something we could actually learn. You know, there are enough people in existence that are descended from the family that we could actually get that those facts on the table. And I think we should. I think that, you know, people should demand that all of the royals put their DNA up to be able to be analyzed and the politicians that, you know, they're involved with as well. I mean, you know, we've talked about Churchill. You know, his family is a Masonic family going back into the 17th century or 18th century. They were high-level Masons. Well, who in the heck are they, for God's sakes? You know, why do they have this bizarre relationship with the Rothschilds? You know, why are the Rothschilds always financially supporting the Churchills? What is the basis of that? You know, I was reading Manchester's book, The Last Lion, and, you know, because we had that show about Churchill, and I was looking through some material on him. And Manchester had this, because he noticed, and of course you know, everyone is aware, that he had all these Jewish bankers that were supporting Winston throughout his entire life. And so Manchester, he just blew it off and he goes, well, you know, it was a different era and people were probably trying to gain political favor. And, you know, I thought, well, wait a second. Are there really a lot of examples of Jewish bankers giving millions of dollars? Because that's what it amounted to, the kind of largesse that they were extending to Winston. They're just giving it away for political, you know, like influence. I mean, I couldn't find another example of this, you see.
Yeah, but so, I mean, it begs the question, though. I mean, political influence. So what is Winston selling?
Yeah, you know. Well, but anyway, so there it is. It's the they are, you know, you can see them. You can see them in the video that I was referencing, which is online. It's called A Conversation on LSD. Mm-hmm. There they are. Okay. They are a group. They created the counterculture, and they're lying in this video about their roles in it. It's very obvious, but the lies break down from time to time, because particularly as the video goes on, they're all drinking alcohol, and you start having, for example, at one point, Hubbard and Leary start laughing about how they had been creating psychosis. They actually exchanged a hand slap. They were so giddy about the fact that they were, it was psychosis that had been.
This is all part of MK Ultra, correct?
Exactly right. Everyone there is an MK Ultra basically operative in one way or another. And so, and they know it. They, of course, are aware of it, because now the pay requisitions are in existence. I'm just saying, for people who dispute the idea of the they, well, here you go.
Well, MKUltra doesn't happen by, you know, it just doesn't, it isn't an act of nature. These are people, it's agency. The people are acting. They're spending other people's money doing this. They're experimenting on people. And this is documented. So when people come out and you'll say, well, they're screwing with your mind with false flag operations. It's a strategy of tension. They're manipulating culture through entertainment and these things, through music, the development of music. Well, MKUltra is an example of that very thing. This broad-based, was that something like 150 sub-projects involving culture, drugs, all types of experimentation, mass dosing, you know, kidnap, more or less kidnapping or dosing people, you know, John's.
They're killing people. Yeah, I mean, there were dozens of people who died in Yoon Cameron's his experimentations, and there was a couple of famous Frank Olson. There are people who they're killing people, and this is all funded secretly by a group. Well, who are they? They are the group in some way that then ends up with 911 that, you know, that we need to get to the bottom of. But you can't just say, well, that they don't exist. They do. There they are.
Mm-hmm. And again, it's one of these things where we've talked about this, and I don't know if we go into great details. Just, you know, of course, your article you did with Jan Ervin regarding the manufacturing the deadhead, and just what that really means about that entire era and the music that meant so much to so many people and still does, right? It still does. And it's hard to get a baby boomer really to accept the fact that they were being played, whether it's the counterculture, even the Cold War. They still believe in these dialectics and these cutouts and this theater that was created for them to get them to a certain destination. But you can pinpoint, you know, you'll talk about MKUltra, how, you know, they had congressional hearings, how children were tortured and sexually abused for the purposes of testing. Now, if that type of malevolence, that type of a moral outlook on things, what does that say about these agencies and the people that staff these agencies? And the fact that this program, I think, involved admittedly, well, like 85 universities, I would say arguably the entire psychiatric profession has been subsumed by it. So, I mean, Ewan Cameron, who's the head of the World Psychological Association, American Psychological Association, he was an MKUltra, one of these big MKUltra guys. So what does that say about psychiatry and psychology?
Right. And what does it say about the public's ability to know the kind of organizing principles and conspiratorial structures of the elites, you see? Because here you have secrecy. If it hadn't been for just a few mistakes on the part of the CIA, no one would ever even have known about MKUltra.
But isn't that part of the, part of the hoodwink, part of the mocking where they just admit it and then nothing's done?
I mean, in this case, they had so many fatalities that they had the Church Commission, and that just blew the whole thing open. But the fact is that no one inside the organization went to the public and goes, I have to whistleblow here because something very evil is going on. Yeah. No one did that. So what kept them together? Well, that's the question we're trying to answer. But you can't argue that they didn't exist as an organization and they weren't able to maintain secrecy.
Yeah, it's but then, yeah, it's and the fact that that this. Or you can point to the coordination between the War Department and the Pentagon and the CIA in Hollywood, and that might affect the movies we see at entertainment fair. And you know the connection where you said with the you know, the creation of the Grateful Dead, Dave McGowan's research regarding the Laurel Canyon scene, the rock music scene, and the countless connections between these major rock bands of the 60s, these musical groups of the 60s, to military, to intelligence, to CIA, and they were producing a culture. You know, this is all part of the whole Vietnam era, which was created to produce this very thing. It was alchemy,
So anyway, the clearest path and the path to, I think most people can best understand is the financial one.
Yeah.
And it's the one I would just say, this is where people should start. They should try to see the financial connections between, you know, all of the secret financial connections that lead to government policy. Right. So now one obvious thing is the amount of money that's being made by the wars.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Halliburton, this is an easy step. It makes a lot of sense. People can see the malevolence and why the secrecy is there. You can look then into the banking families, you know, the Warburgs, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers. You can see how they can benefit from all of the, you know, these financial maneuverings around, particularly during wartime and the creation of weapons. But beyond that, you have to start answering, well, how do they actually keep the secrecy? And what, when you have something like the counterculture or something like the world wars, which are, you know, to my mind, not necessarily financially benefiting anyone, what's the explanation for that? You know, why? I mean, you'd think if they had control over both sides of the trenches, that they would have been a lot more wealth if they had just basically taken over all of Europe as an intact entity, right? Why destroy it? But they did, and they genocided the population. So what's the financial motivation? When you look today at the integration that's going on, the forced integration from Africa and the Middle East into Europe, is that making money for that the oligarchs will then, you know, retain? I mean, that doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, what does make sense is that these policies are designed to genocide a people.
Mm-hmm.
That's what makes sense to me. And so that's why I think we should look at, like in the case of the forced integration into Europe, you should look into the people who are creating it, you know, the EU, the administrators, and try to see, well, who are these people?
Yes, NATO.
It's the same question that should have been asked in World War I, you know. World War I, this is what the combatant should have been asking. It's like, well, what is the real relationship between the political leaders that have put us here in the trenches facing each other and are telling us to shoot the automatic weapons at each other?
That's the function of the political class, to provide cover.
Yeah.
For that, you know, so it's just the stupidity, arrogance of Winston Churchill or of Kaiser Wilhelm or Ludendorff or Bismarck or Nicholas II, you know?
Just any number of like bizarre explanations, but none of them make any sense. Yeah. And that's what World War I is just like really great thing for people to look at, because there every historian that studies it comes up with a different interpretation of motivation, because there are no motivations. So there is no real, you know, kind of strategic geopolitical basis for either side's behavior.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just doesn't make any sense. The war makes a lot more sense as a designed genocide machine than it does as a function of geopolitics. It makes no sense as something that comes out of like geopolitical strategy, because everybody ends up dead and there's no wealth even to be, fought over any longer. So, you know, the populations that are suffering need to come up with some unusual interpretation, some new thinking. You know, see, this is the thing, Tim, is that even if we're wrong, and I want to put that on the table, you know, I could easily, the theories that I put out, not yours, of course, but mine, could be wrong. It's possible. But by God, we are entitled to do some creative thinking at this point, to look at some new explanations, because the explanations about World War I and World War II, the Vietnam War, these are all preposterous, make no sense at all. So we need to do some new thinking. And I think when you look at this this relationship between the secret society and elite Jewish families, it is a point where we can really start to do some really good research, I think. Mm-hmm. We can try to see, well, are these guys related in some way we don't understand? Because if they are, then that will go a long way to helping us understand, well, what makes our history the way it is.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I
just want to make one little digression. This is very meaningful to me. My grandfather was in World War I. He was a Canadian and was in the trenches, and he was mustard gassed. And then years later, when we came back from Japan, my family, we moved to Palos Verdes, and he had been sick his whole life, and he died in our house of lung cancer that was directly related to the mustard gassing in World War I like 40 years earlier.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And so this isn't, you know, just a like an academic problem to me. It's been something that I've, you know, have basically felt my whole life because I had grown close to him. And so it was just a, you know, there was a World War I casualty that was right inside my house. And so I would love to get to the bottom of it and feel that it would really be, you know, a valuable thing, you know, for his legacy, if I'm able to create any, that we at least try to understand what had happened there.
How did he end up in the trenches? Yeah.
Yeah.
How
mustard gas somehow was an okay thing to use against one another.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So total war, you know, it's.
Now, one example of they is, I always like to point out is, the round table group.
Yeah.
And we will talk about, you know, people will be talking about, U.S. Anglo-American policy and these things, the 20th century, how did the United States get involved in two world wars to supposedly pull the British fat out of the fire, the British Empire, in two wars against Germany. And it goes back to this round table organization that was created out of the last will and testament of Cecil Rhodes. Of course, Cecil Rhodes, I think, was a student of this guy Ruskin at Oxford. And this whole view of this unity of the English-speaking peoples. And Cecil Rhodes devoted the latter half of his life. He didn't live very long. He died at age like 44 or 45. But he established this trust that was, I think, administered by Lord Milner. And they created this organization that was dedicated to sort of an organic unity of empire of the English-speaking peoples. And they saw themselves as sort of entitled or destined to rule the world. And what this involved was creating an organization that would slowly but surely reincorporate the United States into the British imperial system. And if you look at the 20th century, it largely succeeded. They created society, you know, like the Pilgrim Society. And, of course, it was the era 1890s was a sort of this reunion of the United States and Great Britain. And there's a big cultural attempt or effort in the United States to draw the United States closer to Great Britain. Of course, this was aided greatly by the interest of the Eastern Seaboard elite, who were Anglophile. And people like Morgan, and of course, Morgan got a start in London and, had ties to the Rothschilds. Same with the Rockefellers, too, so that you always have that.
Oddly enough.
What happens is they successfully get us into the First World War with Woodrow Wilson. After campaigning to keep us out of that war, there's a lot of intrigue here, not just British, but also Jewish. We have the Zionist cause, the Balfour Declaration. And part of the Balfour Declaration was a promise by these Jewish financiers to flex their muscle in the United States to get the United States into the war. They did succeed, and that affected the outcome. It tipped the scales against Germany, and Germany was defeated. And then, of course, after that, you under the auspices of the Round Table, you have the creation of the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which also creates this analog in the United States, the Council of Foreign Relations.
Right.
Yeah, and you have this union of interest of corporate banking interest in the United States and Great Britain. Of course, this sets the stage for the Second World War. But you also had the creation of organizations like the Tavistock Institute, which grew out of the First World War. And Tavistock itself extends its tentacles into the United States, I guess particularly after the Second World War. But Tavistock itself was funded by Rockefellers. And of course, Tavistock is one of these think tanks, and like the RAND Corporation, it involves all types of studies and economic, military, sociological, psychological, through the Royal Institute of International Affairs, through the Council of Foreign Relations, through organizations like Tavistock, RAND Corporation, which also the Stanford Research Institute, which consults with CIA during MKUltra, also consults with the building of Disneyland. And we also know the CIA also helps with the construction of Disney World, you know. And you also see that a lot of the guys that would become the journalists, the newsmen, like Edward R. Murrow or Walter Cronkite, these guys were all spooks. You know, So when we're saying they, well, this is the organizational structure, the whole worldview, whether it's entertainment, news, culture. I think you have done a lot on something like the Princeton Radio Research Project.
Yeah.
And Hadley Cantrell, and this gets into mass communication and the development of mass communication itself is being developed in a way that's meant to manipulate the mass population, mass mind control, just in the MKUltra. So this is...
Well, just to digress, I mean, now you're into Adorno, mm-hmm. I mean, who then, you know, is part of the American Jewish Committee, which then creates, you know, the authoritarian personality, which I think is just a straight pipeline into the creation of MKUltra. Mm-hmm. So you have all of these events being linked, and if you just trace the personalities, you can see, you know, how they actually were all related to one another.
Yeah, and one example of who is they, and we can get into this. The whole the Zionist cause, right? Obviously Israel didn't become a state by accident. It wasn't an act of nature. It's it took agency. It took people acting. It took organization, to say the least. You have this, I think it was formed in 1929. It's the Jewish Agency, and it was founded by Chaim Weizmann, I think the first president of Israel. And it was sort of created to facilitate the creation of the Israeli state. But here's a good example of where we talk about, well, a conspiracy, right? What are they doing? How is this being done? The Jewish Agency had coordinated a massive arms smuggling campaign right after the Second World War. They actually was enabled to deliver B-17 to the Israeli fighters during Israel's war of, they call it the Israeli War of Independence, when Israel was being carved out of Palestine. And it was a massive arms shipment operation that was being conducted in the United States in pretty much 1945 or 44 through 1947. And it's, if I can find the quotes, the notes here. Yeah, the Jewish Agency was the creation of the American Israeli lobby organization, such as the Zionist Organization of America, the American Jewish Committee. Network operatives of the Jewish Agency stole some items from the World War II surplus stockpiles, machine guns, you know, airplanes, bombs, whatever. State-of-the-art fighter airplanes.
B-17s.
Now, how are they able to do this, right? Of course, they did this because, well, the reality is whenever the authorities tried to investigate it, they were stopped. I think there was a classified Naval Intelligence FBI file that exposed that there were where is this? Yeah, 30 years after he saw them, Stephen Green, for his 1984 book, Taking Sides, America's Secret Relationship with Militant Israel. 30 years after he sought them, and nearly 70 years after they were written, these documents, the National Archives and Records Administration declassified them under 2010 Freedom of Information Act request. The files are interesting for their glimpse into the strategies and tactics of these Israel lobby organizations used to escape consequences in the later confrontations with law enforcement, claiming not to know the big picture, conducting key illegal activities offshore and trying to hide clandestine operations and money trails. The files also indicate how law enforcement tactics such as informant developments and mail and communications monitoring, multi-agency information sharing helped provide for a fuller picture of Israeli espionage on U.S. territory and foreign countries such as Panama and Czechoslovakia. Anticipating an armed conflict in Palestine after World War II, the Haganah embarked Haganah was one of these Jewish terrorist organizations. Haganah embarked upon a large-scale effort to buy armaments to be sent to Palestine through front companies with the cooperation of certain Latin American governments. Armed purchased primarily through the War Assets Administration, which sold surplus U.S. military equipment in the wake of World War II, were transferred illegally to Palestine, often via Czechoslovakia. The article places a group of prominent, wealthy, politically connected Jewish Americans referred to as the Sonnenborn Group, a reference to involvement of Rudolf Sonnenborn at the center of the network of Haganah's operations involved in this effort. So you had a vast organization being conducted.
Yeah.
You know, in violation of U.S. law to funnel weapons into Israeli to deliver a fated company to the Palestinians and to create Israel. And this involved, you know, people like Hank Greenspun, the editor out there in Las Vegas, and they were caught. I think Arnon Milchin, the Hollywood producer still alive, was given a medal for his efforts in this. Cause.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I just wanted to say that as you have, like, so concisely spun that whole related strand of history, you, at a couple points, disclose this combination that, you know, that I had mentioned before that I just wanted to comment on. The first was, if you look at the creation of the State of Israel, you actually start with the Freemasons, with Palmerston, mm-hmm. and Salisbury. This is 1842. They are the first ones to actually make the claim that it's time for the Jews to return to their homeland. Mm-hmm. Not coming through Jewish individuals. The whole trajectory, the first 40 years, is completely a kind of Masonic Zionism that then, you know, is transitioned into the organization that Herzl creates. But Herzl is related directly into this organization. We've talked about this before. Even his nickname, Tancred, comes from Disraeli, who was part of the Freemason Zionist project that comes in from the 1840s. So once again, you see this relationship between Jews and secret societies that are purportedly Gentiles. Okay, so it's right in front of you in terms of the creation of Zionism and the State of Israel. And then the other one was when you talked about the Round Table, because now Cecil Rhodes, he had an enormous estate. He, you know, supposedly was one of the wealthiest individuals ever lived. And when he died, he created a will, and I don't know, I won't go into all of the controversy regarding his will, but it was, you know, this highly symbolic document that people dispute as to what it meant. But in any case, all the money ended up being given to Rothschild. Mm-hmm. Right. Now this is very peculiar, because in the will, he talks about the creation of a secret society. You know, you make those references. Those are actually quotes from his will, where he talks about, you know, we need a secret society to kind of rule the world. But he talks about an Anglo-Saxon, mm-hmm. because he reportedly was this Anglo-Saxon. But then, oh, gee whiz, let's give all the money to Rothschild.
Yeah.
So this, of course, makes no sense, but it was a historical fact. Now, one thing in terms of Cecil Rhodes, what is his background? He, you know, purports to be, I think, an Anglican. But he gave a donation to, I believe it was an Anglican church, but I'm positive it was a Christian organization. He gave a large donation at one point in his life. His sister was asked about it, and she said, well, that's really odd considering Cecil's background. And people thought that she was referencing the idea that Cecil Rhodes was a crypto Jew.
Yeah, interesting, right? Yeah.
So that's, you know, those are kind of little, you know, kind of, they're not, you know, that meaningful, but just they become part of a, you know, those statements become part of a pattern where you see, you know, this kind of relationship between secret society, Gentiles, and these elite Jewish families. And then the last one being that Rhodes and Kipling were very close friends with Baron Rothschild and would actually spend their summers with him in Cecil Rhodes' estate in South Africa. And they did this for a number of years. And of course, if you look at Kipling, now once again, we're in the secret society world. He was one of the Freemasons who used the symbol of the swastika in the 19th century in a very bizarre way. And, he used it as a symbol of an animal's obedience to a master. If you look at his books, you'll see elephants being with the swastika on them, bowing down to someone with a whip. And, you again have this, just tantalizing kind of, all of these threads that need basically to be woven together and trying to explain them all to see exactly what we're dealing with. And, these are all candidates for the DNA testing.
Yeah, yeah. Now, another example, one thing that's so frustrating about this is when you get the question, who is they? And you painstakingly go through the effort to name names and you spell out the organizational relationships. You kind of draw out draw the schematic for people. And you still get called a conspiracy nutter, an anti-Semite, or some other horrible name. And you're ostracized and you're ridiculed, regardless of, however strong your case is. And an example of this throughout history, in American history, rather, an example of this in American history, I think, is he probably didn't quite understand the forces he was taking on was the efforts of Charles Lindbergh in opposition to America's entry into World War I and the American First Committee, because you sort of have this Midwestern America First Committee, sort of naive. They think their government's supposed to represent them, and the United States is supposed to be away from European conflicts, not knowing the full extent of the power of their opponents. But he gives a speech, and this is just an example of someone who identifies the malefactors, the schemers, but then is subsequently ridiculed and condemned in history for doing such. Charles Lindbergh, in the September 11th, 1941 Des Moines speech, and I'll read a little bit from it. He goes,
9/11?
Yeah, September 11th, 1941. Yeah. it is now, I'll take excerpts from the speech just a little bit, just to make the primary points. He said, it is now 2 years since the latest, it is now 2 years since the latest European war began. From that day in September 1939 until the present moment, there has been an ever-increasing effort to force the United States into the conflict. This effort has been carried out on by foreign interest and by a small minority of our own people, but it has been so successful that today our country stands on the verge of war. When this war was started in Europe, it was clear that the American people were solidly opposed to entering it. Why shouldn't we be? We had the best defensive position in the world. We had tradition of independence from Europe, and the one time we did take part in a European war, left European problems unsolved and debts to America unpaid. The national polls showed that when England and France declared war on Germany in 1939, less than 10% of our population favored a similar course for America. But there were various groups of people here and abroad whose interests and beliefs necessitated the involvement of the United States in the war. I shall point out some of these groups. He's naming names. I shall point out some of these groups tonight, outline their methods of procedure. In doing this, I must speak with the utmost frankness, for in order to counteract their efforts, we must know exactly who they are.
Who they are.
Yeah, he goes, the three most important groups, and this is what he got in trouble for, the three most important groups who have been pressing this country toward war are the British, the Jewish, and the Roosevelt administration. Behind these groups, but of lesser importance, are a number of capitalist, Anglophiles, intellectuals who believe that the future of mankind depends upon the domination of the British Empire. Add to these the communist groups who were opposed to intervention until a few weeks ago, and I believe I have named the major war agitators in this country. Now, for that speech, he was more or less called an anti-Semite, and a true American hero was more or less blacklisted. Now, what he said was true, and it's been not only not because I say it's true, or he believes it's true, or his support, or Charles Lindbergh's supporters say it's true, is those very people he named say it's true because, well, one thing we know a lot about the British efforts in the United States in the run-up to the war. William Stevenson, the man called Intrepid, he was coordinating with the Roosevelt administration out of Rockefeller Center, engaged in all types of espionage, blackmail, bribery, some say even murder, involving themselves in elections. Like we hear a lot about Russia getting involved in elections. What about British? So you had this British fifth column operating in the United States in cahoots with the Roosevelt administration to get us into the war. In many cases, getting Roosevelt to like things like submit a forged map showing that the Third Reich had plans on attack America via South America, absurd things like that. So this is William Stevenson, British security coordination operating out of Rockefeller Center. But even then, I think it was Rabbi Stephen Wise who, after the war, took credit for getting the U.S. into the war and ultimately defeating Hitler because his group, the American Jewish Committee, the American Zionist Council, had the foresight to get America into the war. And much of the British effort is detailed in Thomas Miles' book, Desperate Deception, British Covert Operations in the United States, 1939 to 1944. He details the British efforts. But my point is that everything Lindbergh said was true. He's called an anti-Semite and a horrible person for saying it. But after the war, they admit what he said was true. And no one says that he was vindicated because after the war, America's entry is justified because the Third Reich was so evil. So I'm, So
circular logic. That's a very, very good point. I would also then go to the conclusion of World War II and to another individual that was talked about as being an anti-Semite, which is General Patton. Eisenhower was overseeing these concentration camps that had German POWs.
Yeah, the Rhine-Meadow camps, yeah.
Yeah, and they're being starved to death. Patton took issue with it. He found out about it. And he was very upset about it. He wrote letters, I think it was to his sister. And I've seen the letter, but I'm not positive as to who the address he was. I believe it was his sister. But the letter stated that this is a Semitic action, and I can prove it. He actually used those words. He said, this is a Semitic action, and I can prove it. This was just before his untimely death. But my question is what would have been his evidence had he lived? Mm-hmm. What is the, this, as he described it, Semitic action, which is basically responsible for the genocide of these Gentiles. This is like it's a very legitimate question, particularly in the context that you've established with Lindbergh as to how we got in the war. Mm-hmm. and so here you have another question that's on the table that we don't have answers to, but we should try to, try to find out.
Mm-hmm. And at the very least, if there are these organizations, these groups, whether it be they Jewish or British, or whatever, and they're operating, they should be forced to operate in full sunshine. And they should have to stake out their positions, and they have to defend them. They shouldn't be able to operate in secret and deprive people of their livelihoods or their lives, for that matter, terrorize them or engage in some sort of slander campaign to ostracize them and keep them from being able to take part in everyday life because you oppose a certain amount of a particular policy that they're advocating. If the American Jewish Committee wants to advocate for U.S. entry into the war, and someone like Charles Lindbergh opposes it, they should be able to debate the merits of that policy without calling him names, anti-Semite, or some horrible insult or something, or and that goes for anyone else who's critical of a policy. If you're critical of the Israeli government, doesn't mean you should deprive the livelihood, like happened to Dorothy Thompson after the war, this well-known lady journalist who lost her national syndicated radio show because she was critical of what was going on after the war in Palestine. And the same thing, it's one of these things where we in a free society, we should be able to engage in open debate and discuss these things and debate the merits or lack thereof of a particular policy without being called horrible names and being
the logic is the logic and the facts are the facts, and we shouldn't, you know, you should be able to bring him without having all of the analytic process stopped by this one powerful racial slur of anti-Semite. You know, that's basically what you're saying, and I couldn't agree more. But, you know, you mentioned at the beginning of the comment that, you know, full sunlight. Yeah. You need full sunlight. Well, to me, that's DNA, because I really want to know, you know, when Roosevelt and, you know, and Warburg and, you know, some other, you know, like a Masonic individual, you know, support one another, and you have, you know, a kind of, you know, this idea that there's just all sorts of people supporting, you know, a position of getting us into war. Well, okay, who are these people? Mm-hmm. Who are they really? And that involves DNA testing. And so I just think that that's something we really need to insist upon, because, you know, there's just, in my mind, Tim, there's just so much evidence showing that there is a kind of crypto influence in history. And I don't pretend to know where it always exists or who was always involved in this. But, you know, when you see things like Cecil Rhodes' will and his sister's comments, and when you read Patton's letters, you know, you want to know who these people are. And we really need to get to the bottom of it. And so we shouldn't be afraid to ask for DNA testing any more than we should be afraid of having people hurl the charge of anti-Semitism at us.
Yeah.
They're basically the same thing. They're just devices, you know, to stop us from getting to the truth. We want sunlight, and we need it, because, you know, if you look at basically what's going on in Europe today, I mean, what is the future of the European ethnicities 100 years from now? Well, I would say it's zero, you know. So there is this. If you care about this in any way, this is the time to step up and demand some answers in terms of who are the people who are leading to the policies that end up with genocide.
Yeah, and I think throughout history, leaders or titular leaders have made comments about who really runs things. I mentioned that Disraeli quote about persons that are ruled by persons that we never see or hear from. And I think even Churchill himself during the Second World War talked about a high cabal running things. Lenin.
Yeah. It's funny how they always like to bring this up, you know, that there is this secret organization that runs everything and no one knows. I mean, I could give you I couldn't do it right now, but I mean, with a few days, I could give you a half dozen quotes, all of the same genre, where a famous, powerful person goes, you know, there is just this organization out there that runs everything. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover actually talked about this. Mm-hmm. So when you confront someone, you know, who uses the question, you know, who are they, with the idea that this will end the discussion, you know, because they have such a powerful point that there can't possibly be a conspiracy organized in this way. Oh, my gosh. If anyone who does the research into this phenomena, you know, this the idea of the famous people saying, hey, there's a group. I mean, look at, for example, H.G. Wells' quote. You know, about the open conspiracy.
Yeah, open conspiracy. Right.
Well, what is that referring to? You know, so the thing is they are telling us. They love to tell us the truth. It's a way of ridiculing us. It's a way of, you know, the idea is we're too stupid to even know the truth when we're told it.
Yep.
And it's a kind of humiliation. Well, we have to basically show the oligarchs and this group that, you know, we're not that stupid.
Yeah.
And so we should organize ourselves to be able to, you know, find out the reality and give it out as information to everybody.
Yep. Jay, think we covered it?
Brother, I think we did it in spades. And so, you know, who is they? Well, it's them.
They is them.
All right, Tim, thank you so much.
Great. Yeah, we'll pick a, we'll pick among those topics. So I'll talk with you. We'll pick one from that bunch.
They're all great topics. Yeah, it'll be fun.
Great. Listen, enjoy your weekend then.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye.
Good evening. Bye-bye.